So this is based on work with my supervisor Laurent. These two references here. What we'll do is look at a null surface in GR. So the null surface is at finite distance, and it's not a horizon or anything, just a general null surface. And we look at the geometry of that, connect that to the degrees of freedom, identify what I want to call a boundary current, figure out a conservation law for that, and lastly, look at the Hamiltonians. So that's the plan. Why do we want to do that? Why are we looking at null surfaces? Well, null surfaces are physically distinguished. For example, if you think about domains of dependences, they're bounded by null surfaces. Of course, there's many applications. For example, null infinity is a null surface in a certain way. Black hole horizons, obviously. So they're very special places, and there's lots of applications of that. What we do is we'll identify the degrees of freedom, but we'll be careful not to gauge fix. So we'll take along the gauge degrees of freedom. Why do we want to do that? Because not all diffeomorphisms are gauge. Some of them become sort of non-local degrees of freedom, which have been called edge modes. So we want to be able to keep track of these. If you want, there's also a pragmatic reason, which is that it's much easier to fix the gauge than to change the gauge. So once you fix the gauge, you're committed. But we can still gauge fix later. So I mentioned we look at a conservation law for this boundary current, which is a canonical object. So why do we want canonical conservation laws? This is importing some understanding from research at null infinity, where these have been understood to be important, for example, in connection to soft theorems and asymptotic symmetries. It also allows us to identify some sort of canonical perspective on previous work on the membrane paradigm, where there's also conservation laws, but they're not usually interpreted canonically. I think I wrote it in the abstract, and we keep coming back to the metric degrees of freedom at the corner of the null surface, so the corner phase space. The motivation for that is that it's sort of ambiguous, the corner phase space, and at least I don't really understand what that means. So we look at that, how that influences the Hamiltonians and other things. Okay. So first chapter is the degrees of freedom, then conservation laws, then Hamiltonians. Let's get started. So the degrees of freedom in our way of doing things, they're contained in the presymplectic potential, theta, which is the boundary term of the variation of Lagrangian. And so this is something you integrate on a co-dimension one surface. And once you do that, then morally, what you get is of the form integral over p delta q. So you can read off the p's and q's from the symplectic potential. We'll get back to the scare quotes here somewhat. This definition is a bit ambiguous. You can fiddle with the total variation in here and the total derivative in here. So the usual starting point here is the what I want to call the Wald symplectic potential, which takes this form here. So a different choice is the ADM symplectic potential, which I guess most of you are familiar with. So why do we redo this analysis for a null surface when it's already been done by ADM? The reason is that on a null surface, the induced metric becomes degenerate, so this goes to zero. But because it's degenerate, the inverse metric blows up. So it, like the ADM construction doesn't have a good limit on the null surface. That's why we need to do the work that we do.
Perhaps also ADM is missing some corner or edge variables. So it's kind of already referring to some information.
The ADM differs from the Wald symplectic potential by a corner term. Mm-hmm. We won't see this particular one, but we'll get back to the corner terms. It's going to come.
Do you know what the formula has a bit different spread than the central CPU order.
Not precisely. It involves the variation of the shift.
Okay.
And then there's a lapse, I think, in the denominator, but I'm not sure.
Does it make sign compare?
It's what?
Does it make sign compare? Which is the lapse is contributed to the variation. So it's not just a corner thing, it's
yeah.
It's not contains less degrees of freedom. So
all right, so to get around this degeneracy of the induced metric, what we want to do is split the null surface, which is the thick black thing here, into spheres, which are codimension two spatial spheres. So this null surface is part of some foliation, and it's foliated itself by some sort of time u. And at the u equal constant surfaces, we have p minus two spheres sitting here. They carry an induced metric. Then we also have the null generators spanning the surface. I want to call them L. And they're normalized with respect to this u time. And there's also a transverse null vector or covector, which I call K. So that leads to a decomposition of the metric into a sphere metric and this null diet here in the normal directions. What we consider is sort of a portion of a null surface with some initial corner and some final corner. So if you think about phase space, then this doesn't really define a phase space. The domain of dependence is empty. So to have an actual phase space, you would have to sort of cap it off at the top, for example, or have the top as a point.
What do you say is domain of dependence is empty? You're including this at the top surface.
No, I'm not including the top surface. That's you could shrink it to a point, the top surface, and then. All right, the null surface also has some extrinsic geometry, which is contained in the Weingarten map, which is sort of the null analog of extrinsic curvature. The extrinsic variables are the shear, which tells you how shapes change from one time slice to the next. It's the expansion, which tells you how size changes or area changes from one surface to the next. Then it's the surface gravity and the twist. Both of these are sort of you can understand them by ratios of length of the null normal. And for my intuition, what I do is I think of this length as sort of a photon frequency. So ratio of length is a redshift. And from that perspective, we can understand the surface gravity as here a redshift over time. And the twist is sort of, if you go sideways on the surface, the frequency will also change with respect to covariant transport. So the gradient of that is encoded in the twist. These are sort of intuitions, so don't take them too literally. But yeah.
Sorry, why do you say the first two, the shear and the expansion, why do you say that they're extrinsic geometry? Aren't they intrinsic to the null surface?
Yeah, you're right. I'm using these terms a bit loosely here, I guess. So they are determined by the induced metric on the null surface.
That's right.
They are extrinsic to the sphere, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. There's an extra variable, which is h, which encodes the size of the geometry normal to the spheres. So you can define it as the ratio of the volume elements on space-time by the volume on the sphere. And we're going to meet that again.
A lot of these things are not, in some sense, covariant.
That's true. We'll also see how that comes together. So then we're going to compare nearby geometries in the symplectic geometry. And we have a restriction on variations, which is that they actually leave the surface null. And gamma is going to be the variation of the, so it's trace free and encodes the variation of the conformal metric. And the delta q here is the variation of the area. All right, and we also see the variation of the size of the normal geometry, So H is not covariant, but delta H is covariant in a certain way. All right. So let's use all this data to describe the degrees of freedom on the null surface. What we get by massaging this equation, inserting lots of identities and integrating lots of parts, we get an integral on the null surface B plus an integral on the corner of the null surface B. So let's look first at the null surface part here. It's a sum of three terms. The first one here involves the shear, which is conjugate to the conformal metric. The second is the twist, which is conjugate to what you can think of as infinitesimal translations. And the third one is the area, which is conjugate to mu. Mu is called the spin zero momentum, and it's a linear combination of the surface gravity and the expansion, which D is the space-time dimension. So let's interpret that a little bit. The first pair, that the conformal metric is conjugate to the shear, that's well known. As you said, the shear is in some sense intrinsic to the null surface. It's the time derivative of the conformal metric. So we have the conformal metric conjugate to its own time derivative. And that's like a typical feature of null surfaces, that you have a variable which is conjugate to its own derivative along the surface. The next one is here that we have the delta L, which is conjugate to the twist. The twist has also been called the Hayek field, and it appears in the membrane paradigm, where it's also interpreted as a momentum from a sort of fluid analogy perspective. So what you can see here is that this momentum of the membrane paradigm is actually the momentum in the canonical GR sense, which is a nice extra interpretation, I guess. And if you integrate this against the rotation, then it gives the angular momentum of black holes. All right, that's that. And the spin zero momentum here, which is a combination of surface gravity and expansion. For black holes, the event horizon is non-expanding. So that would just be kappa, which is interpreted as the temperature. In the membrane paradigm, the interpretation is a bit different. It would be a combination of pressure and the bulk viscosity term. Right. What we can also read from the symplectic potential is a connection to black hole thermodynamics. I won't go into that much, but you have the angular momentum conjugate to some sort of angular velocity parameter, and here temperature, if you will, to area, which is entropy. So that's also familiar from that perspective. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can do that. Yeah.
Quite a couple of questions. So your A capital A, that's a two-dimensional index.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, but L is a null generator of the horizon,
mm-hmm.
is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So why does it have a spatial?
That's a good question.
Spatial component.
When
you take the variation, are you allowing that null generator to move around the surface or not?
We fix the normalization with respect to the foliation parameter U. So the U component of L doesn't vary under our variation. That's why the variation is tangential to the sphere, and I've put a capital index. Yeah. So the length of that is not allowed to vary, but we do allow it to vary along the sphere. Oh, I see. That's we didn't fix that. That's if you want a gauge degree of freedom. But we're trying to keep the gauge degrees of freedom.
Do you mean
that?
So you get your torque, don't you?
Yeah, it's a sort of shift.
Yes.
Within the night surface.
But shifts you usually get by projecting something down onto the surface, but you can't do that in this case.
Well, the null vector field would be d by du plus some shift with the sphere derivative.
Yeah.
So delta L is actually just the variation of that. Does that answer the question?
I guess so. Yeah, I mean, I guess
okay.
You could
choose the coordinates so that that would be all identical.
Yeah,
zero,
yeah, that would be a gauge.
Right now, second bar.
Ah, okay.
No.
Oh, no. It's
not. So we have LADA is DU plus that's the shift times the sphere derivative. Okay, so I said if we do that game with a symplectic potential, we find the integral on the null surface, which we just looked at, and we also find the integral on the corner, which is a two-dimensional surface in 4D. And there we have the area of the corner, which is conjugate to the size of the normal geometry. So that's an extra canonical pair. And then there's also a total variation here, but that's not really a degree of freedom because it doesn't enter the symplectic form. But now the symplectic potential was defined implicitly through the variation of the Lagrangian, so it's only defined up to a total derivative or an exact piece, which means the integrated symplectic potential is only defined up to a corner integral. So there's some ambiguity here, and the most covariant choice for the symplectic potential is Wald's choice, this one. But if we sacrifice a bit of covariance, we can drop this corner integral on the null surface, which would be sort of a minimal choice of symplectic potential for the null surface. And we'll come back to the implications of doing that.
I should have asked this before, but the action that you're bearing, is it purely the scalar curvature on a tiny number?
Yeah,
have
yeah,
you added,
thanks for asking.
Normally you want to add some sort of surface expression, some boundary term.
They're here.
You're coming in.
Yeah. The polarizations and boundary actions, this was also analyzed in detail in this paper. Raphael is one of the authors. So looking at the expressions of the symplectic potential, we have in there some variations of extrinsic quantities rather than intrinsic quantities. Both in the integral on the surface and in the integral on the corner. So that's not the Dirichlet polarization, if you will. If it was Dirichlet, then we would only be allowed to have variations of the induced metric on the null surface. So we can vary by parts here to shuffle the variation on the induced geometry. And the total derivatives that we pick up, they can be absorbed into boundary actions. So the boundary action that does the job in this case would be the integral over the null surface of kappa plus theta plus this corner integral of area times normal area. That would be the boundary and indeed corner action needed to switch polarizations to the Dirichlet one. And the kappa plus theta is the divergence of the null normal. So that looks a lot like the null analog of Gibbons-Hawking. But there's also this corner piece. Okay, so we have the momenta of the induced metric on the null surface. which means in four dimensions that we have five canonical pairs. Because see, an induced metric would have six components, but it's a null surface, so that restricts one, and we have five pairs. So what about the sixth pair? Or in other words, what's the momentum that's conjugate to departure from nullness? So that would be lifting our restriction on the variations. And this has been worked out by these people just this year. And the answer is that the momentum conjugate to the departure from nullness is the transverse acceleration. So that takes the same functional form as our surface gravity, except with L and K switched. So that's the momentum conjugate. There's a subtlety here, which is a bit complicated. If you want the full brackets or the full Hamiltonians, allowing these variations to depart from null, you would have to calculate all the momenta for allowing for configurations where the surface is not null, which is not what we've done. So this is sort of going part way.
Is there any reason why you'd want to do that?
Turn on the nullness?
Well,
one would be if you want to consider sort of symmetries which are transverse to the null surface, because those wouldn't preserve nullness generally unless you restrict them to be like constant across the null surface. But we're not doing that here either. All right, so we've sort of gone through this part here, the geometry and the degrees of freedom. Next, let's look at this boundary current, the conservation law, and symmetries. I start with an example, the massless scalar field. So if you calculate the energy of the massless scalar field on some bounded space-like surface sigma, you get here, it's the value of the Hamiltonian. Now if you ask for a conservation law associated with this value of the energy, what you find is that the change in time of energy is some flux across the boundary of the surface. And this flux is of the following form. You have the normal derivative to the boundary, which is, from a canonical perspective, it's the sort of the momentum, which talks to phi dot here. So we have that energy is conserved up to a flux pq dot for the scalar field. So now we want to do something like that for gravity. So we're going to consider a space-time region, which is bounded by a null surface, p. Instead of energy, we'll have energy momentum, because it's gravity and it's covariant. And we know from local diffeomorphism symmetry that the value of energy will actually be, the density will be sort of a density on the boundary of the region, so density on B. And instead of this conservation, we'll have a covariant local conservation. So it's the divergence of some current, some sort of induced energy momentum current. So let's try to find what the ingredients of this picture are. What's the boundary current J, and what form will the fluxes take? Before we do that, we'll have to figure out what this dot here means exactly for gravity. In other words, how do the symmetries act on the variables? You might think just by Lie derivative, but we've introduced some background structure here in the game. We've got this foliation U, which breaks covariance. As Raphael said, the variables are not quite covariant. So to control the action of the symmetries, we define the field space Lie derivative, which instead of just taking the space-time Lie derivative of a tensor, it varies the tensor by the metric and then takes the Lie derivative of the metric. So it sort of derives tensors according to the metric dependence rather than according to their space-time indices. So we consider only symmetries which are tangential to the null surface and split them up into a null bit and a bit which is tangential to the cross section. And you get something for the symmetries. The interesting ones are this one, the action on the spin zero momentum, because it actually it involves the second derivative in time of this parameter f. So the spin zero momentum sort of transforms as a connection under these null diffeomorphisms. That's one thing. The other thing is the transformation of the size of the normal geometry. That's the only transformations that, that we have that depends on the transverse derivative of the symmetry parameter. All the other ones, they depend only on the restriction of the vector field to the null surface, but the transformation of H depends on how the vector field looks next to the null surface also. So in some sense, this is the odd one out. So the transformations are not quite covariant because of our background structure, but the punchline is they're sort of under control.
Mm-hmm. I'm confused about how this could be the field space Lie derivative, because if you had a tensor that was metric independent, this is just zero, right?
Yes.
But in general, like for if you do the field space Lie derivative of two like Diffeo generators, you get this Barnett and others bracket, which is the Lie bracket plus the metric dependent transformations.
Well, you think
that doesn't seem like it would correspond to this, right?
Are you thinking about the algebra of these?
I'm just saying that's an example where this thing would be zero.
Yeah.
For field independent, but for the for whatever.
Yeah. Okay.
But in general, I feel like it should have just involved a Lie derivative of the tensor.
But this is the action of the field space Lie derivative on a field space scalar. So T is a tensor on spacetime here, but a scalar on field space.
Okay.
So to get the bracket between two field space vectors, you would need the action of that on the field space vector field, which I haven't, which would translate to this, the Banach bracket.
Okay.
So. We've seen how the symmetries act on the variables. Now we'd like to produce this equation that the divergence of the boundary current is a flux, which is to be of the form pq dot. And now the q dot is replaced by the action of the symmetries on the variables. The way to get at this equation is that this equation is just the constraint, which is the, you know, the normal component of the Einstein tensor. So you you massage that a little bit using, again, the decomposition of the identity. That's a bit like the derivation of Gauss-Kodazzi relations in the ADM formalism. Then we smear it and integrate by parts. So what you find is that the divergence of this boundary current is has one bit which comes from the matter energy momentum, and then the other bits are the shear contracted with the transformation of the conformal metric, then the twist with the variation of the null generator, and then here outside the area with the variation of the variable. Now, if you compare this to the symplectic potential, no surprise, this one is just this one with a delta replaced by an L, and the same here, just replace delta by an L, and the same for the last one. So remembering that the symplectic potential is of the form P delta Q, we've done the first step. We have a conservation law where the fluxes are P transformation of Q. All right, so far so good. I haven't told you what J is. So what's J? J eats a vector field psi, which we decompose into a null part and the part tangential to the sphere. So let's look first at the part tangential sphere. So that means the symmetry we're considering is sort of a spatial translation. And so we expect this current to know about momentum. So the current for the spatial symmetry, it has two parts. One is parallel to the null generator, and that's the contraction of the symmetry with the twist. And now remember, the twist is also the momentum for delta L. So this canonical momentum here becomes interpreted as the momentum that also talks to this translation symmetry. So that makes sense. And then there's a second bit in this current here, which is along the sphere. That's the shear contracted with the symmetry parameter here. So you can think of that as a spatial momentum current induced on the surface. Right. So let's look at symmetries which are parallel to the null generators. So thinking of the null generator as time, the value of the current would be interpreted as energy. So now the current is only as a null piece. It doesn't have a spatial piece, which tells us there's no spatial energy current. That's something that's peculiar to null surfaces, that for the null translations, you don't have any spatial current associated. And it's just a definition. This bracket here could be called the energy aspect. And it involves the momentum conjugate to the area, but it's not only the momentum conjugate to the area. So the spin zero sector, it's the correspondence between the current and the degrees of freedom is not as neat. There's more mixing.
Mm-hmm. Isn't those spatial energy current, do you mean that this is really, there's only energy flux in directions along the generator? Yeah. By spatial, you mean the transverse spatial sections?
Yeah, spatial, I mean along the spheres.
Along the spheres.
Along the cross sections.
So it's one of the ones, I see.
Yeah. All right. Let's try to see how the corner phase space plays into that story about conservation. We had that the wild symplectic potential is a piece on the null surface plus a piece on the corner. But now in our conservation law, only the null surface piece featured, but not the corner piece. So what's happened there? It would be possible to put the corner piece back in here in this correspondence. And what we would find instead of the J, our boundary current, would be the Komar charge K, which is of this form. So it has here a derivative along the null surface of the symmetry parameter, but also here a derivative transverse to the null surface along the symmetry parameter. So if we had included this corner phase space in the conservation law here, then we would have found that the current depends on transverse derivatives of the parameter.
When you say transverse, do you mean off of the surface?
Off the surface, yeah. Yeah. I mean, that wouldn't be the end of the world, I guess. But if we're trying to define a phase space sort of by looking at a null surface, it certainly makes life more complicated if things depend on the extension of symmetries off the null surface. So writing the constraints as we did in the variables that also appeared in the bulk symplectic structure, it sort of suggested that we should be using only the null surface symplectic potential here and drop the corner phase space. So if you want, that's a possible criterion of fixing the corner ambiguity. The criterion would be that the transformation of the variables should not depend on the extension of the symmetry parameter. And the ADM phase space is also of that, would satisfy this criterion. That the ADM momentum and the induced metric, their transformations do not depend on how you extend the symmetry of the surface. So let's call the null surface piece here the intrinsic symplectic potential, because the transformation is only intrinsic. And you asked about covariance and under diffeomorphisms. And the answer to that, it's almost covariant. So there's a way to make it wholly covariant. There's some total derivatives of the sphere. So some technical things, but it's covariant in speed.
Mm-hmm. You talked about the corner including or not including it in the phase space.
Mm-hmm.
If you included it, what does it mean? You get a kind of, your current, it doesn't affect your current away from the corner, is that right? It only affects it at the corner, or in the way you were describing it, I couldn't tell.
Mm-hmm.
Are you converting it into a volume integral on the surface?
It would modify the current also away from the corner. So we had that the divergence of the current equals some flux. And now if we include the corner phase space, what that would do is to add to the flux some extra flux, but the extra flux is a total derivative because the phase space is at the corner. So what that would do here is add the same total derivative.
But that all when you integrate it, around continues to still.
Mm-hmm.
It's a total derivative, but I mean, is that a way of re-expressing everything so that the variation, so that the change is only at the corner?
The change of.
Maybe I should leave the question for later.
Okay. All right, so we've looked at the geometry, degrees of freedom. We understood how the symmetries act, how they form the boundary current, and how the fluxes determine the conservation law of the boundary current through the constraints. So the last thing that's missing here is understanding what symmetries are generated by the canonical sense. So we look at the Hamiltonians. So in order to figure out the Hamiltonians, we need the symplectic form. And we'll take here the symplectic form that's derived from the intrinsic symplectic potential, which is the one without the corner phase space. So I call this little h, that's the symplectic form, where you fill one of the slots with the Lie derivative of the metric. And the symmetry is a pure gauge symmetry if this little h vanishes. And it's a Hamiltonian symmetry if the h is the variation of something. I think that's familiar. So what we do is we take the symmetry parameter again to be a sphere vector field plus some parameter times the null generator. Now the null generators, we haven't fixed them. So they're metric dependent. There's some components of the metric. That means under variations, our symmetry vector field sort of tracks along with the null lines. If you move the null lines a little bit, then the symmetry vector field sort of moves in the same way. So it's a metric dependent symmetry, and we see the consequence of that. If you calculate this, the result is that H here has a piece that's a total variation, so that's Hamiltonian. And it's the integral of the U component of our boundary current. So that's the integrable bit of the Hamiltonian. And then there's this bit here, which is not not a priori an exact variation. And we'll analyze that. First note that this non-integrable bit here looks a lot like the symplectic potential. So it's some sort of symplectic flux term that arises from the, because you're translating the corner with the symmetry. It has the shear piece and it has the spin zero piece, but it doesn't have the spin one piece. So where has that gone? The reason why that's disappeared is exactly because we've made the generators track along with the null lines. So the symplectic flux from that pair and the symplectic potential is compensated by the metric dependence of the symmetries we're considering. All right. So what do we have to do to make sure that this is an exact variation and thus that the symmetry is Hamiltonian, that it can be implemented as a Hamiltonian symmetry on phase space?
I think I missed, what is the metric dependence of, like, what's the requirement for the generator?
We've set it to be some metric independent sphere vector field plus the metric independent parameter f times the null generator L.
The null surface is what you're saying. It maps a null surface to itself. So.
No, that wouldn't be the metric dependence. The metric dependence is because the L here is metric dependent.
But C is tangent to the surface B, the null surface?
Yeah, it's tangent to the null surface.
That's
what it was. What? Well, because it's metric dependent.
The nullness, yeah, but we fixed the nullness on the variations.
So what else is causing it to be metric? Like, why else would you
make metric dependence? Because LA is the U plus this this shift here.
Uh-huh.
And the shift is some components of the metric. So we're allowing under variations for the null lines to sort of tilt a little bit. So those are metric dependencies here in the psi. Okay. So what would we have to do if
the arbitrariness of V doesn't somehow eat the U and that U anchor. So you, if you rotate it like just V plus F DU, wouldn't look.
No, it wouldn't give the same result, I don't think. Unless you make V metric dependent in the way that L was metric dependent before.
But then. But the size reads in one way or the other span the same space. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean,
is the subspace where V is equal to zero, which is special.
I suppose, yeah, the easiest way to see it if V is equal to zero.
Maybe a way to ask the question is why the V part doesn't contribute with the delta L piece, with the spin 1 piece. So the
because
the L carries along the L, which is what you're saying, but the V piece
because we've chosen V to be metric independent. Yeah, there would be several ways one could specify the metric dependence of Xi, and this is just one possibility. One could also take it to be not metric, totally metric independent, and then one would find the omega delta U and U. So there's several options, and this is just one from the range of possibilities.
So I can extract the LPs from C. How, like, besides looking at that formula, can I extract it in terms of the induced metric and how?
If you know the level surfaces of U, then you can. So the split here, that relies on the background structure, which I've called K before. So we use the pullback of K for transfers.
But it annihilates the induced metric.
L?
No, C. Or not. Or can you use the induced metric to get the L component?
No, to get the L component, no. Because L annihilates the induced metric. Yeah, that would just get the V component. But I guess the point is that the split here depends on the background structure U that we have put. Okay, so in which case is this actually Hamiltonian? And in which case is the symmetry actually Hamiltonian symmetry? The easiest case is if you restrict attention to symmetries that don't move the corner. So that means the coefficient of L, which is transverse to the corner, vanishes at the corner. And what you get for the Hamiltonian is one piece here coming from the rotation along the surface, which again, the rotations are generated just by the linear momentum, by the twist, which we've seen in many spots. And then you also have this derivative along the null surface of F, the parameter. So while we're choosing F to vanish on the surface, the derivative of the surface can still be non-zero, and indeed has a non-zero Hamiltonian generator, which is just the area element of the corner. So that's the easiest case. But what if we want to consider symmetries that move the corner around? In order to make those Hamiltonian, we would have to put some extra conditions on the variables. And there's sort of two extremes. The first one would be fixing the geometry of the corner. So you fix the conformal metric and the volume element. And what?
Sorry, I maybe missed something you said. In the first case where you choose F to vanish on the surface, mm-hmm. you're saying you're killing this, like, from the little h formula, which is this would-be variation, exact variation, mm-hmm. you're killing the second term, or not? Like, what is more subtle? Because
this one is gone.
That's gone, and what happens to the other?
This one?
Yes.
That's subtle. Because if you execute the variation, and you have delta L, but delta L is tangential to the sphere, and F vanishes on the sphere, so it's tangential to the sphere. But good question.
And the mu?
The what, sorry?
The mu, the moment, the scalar moment, spin zero moment.
Ah, sorry, there's a typo here. It's supposed to be F. Yeah, thanks. Yeah, there's an F missing here in front of the mu.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Mu times F, yeah. All right. So if we do have symmetries that displace the corner, one extreme would be to fix the geometry of the corner, which is of makes this term into a total variation also. And what you find you could call the Dirichlet Hamiltonian. And In that, the null translations are generated by the expansion. And the rotations or translations along the sphere that are still generated by the same. The other extreme would be, instead of fixing the geometry of the corner, fix the momenta, so fix the shear to zero, and fix the mu plus derivative of f to zero. And what you find, you could call the Neumann Hamiltonian. It takes this form. So this is really just the U component of the boundary current that we had earlier. So that's the Neumann Hamiltonian. And what you could also do is something in between. If for example you make mu depend on the area element here, that makes sure that the product is a total variation. You can pull out the total variation, and you will get different Hamiltonians for sort of intermediate polarizations. Notice that this expression here, through the J here, it involves the F on the surface, on the corner surface, plus the first derivative of F off the surface. So these two are functionally independent. So, borrowing language from null infinity, you could think of null translations as super translations. So what we have here is not one copy of super translations, but two copies. One being actual translations, and the others being rescalings of the null parameter. And that was analyzed in detail in this paper by Chandrasekharan, Prabhu, Flanagan just a couple of weeks ago. Okay, let's recap what we've seen. We've expressed the degrees of freedom of gravity on a null surface in terms of the geometry, the intrinsic and extrinsic geometry of the null surface. We've interpreted the smeared constraint as a conservation law for a boundary current, which you can think of as an induced current on the null surface. And the fluxes take the canonical form P transformation of Q. And we've looked a little bit at different choices of corner phase spaces. And we saw that by a specific choice of corner phase space, we could remove the dependence of the current Hamiltonians on the transverse derivative or the extension of the symmetry properties. And lastly, we've looked at the Hamiltonians and the conditions for, if you want, Hamiltonicity for the symmetries which are tangential to the null surface. Okay, thanks.
Did you guys, for these Hamiltonians with the metric-dependent generators, did you bother to compute the Poisson brackets of different ones to work out the algebra?
I think the
reason it might be interesting is because when you have metric-dependent generators, that's usually when you can see the central charges show up. So you might actually get like a centrally extended EMS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I think these people have looked into the algebra. I'm not quite sure, but I think they have a different choice of corner phase space, and I'm not sure if they consider metric dependent generators. But I would have to look. But thanks for that.
More questions? Is there some simple connection of this to the bottom in your observed thing to the body flux and so on?
Connection, yes. I'll drop the adjective sim.
Okay.
Yeah, that's we're currently working on things related on that.
Can you repeat the question?
The question was that J sub C or whatever you wrote, and its divergence Are they related to the bodily mass at Scar Plus and the flux, you know, the news, I think it's called the news function, which is the flux that covers the change in the bodily mass from one cross section to another?
But the flux was, one of the pieces was sigma L psi gamma. So if you take psi to be a time, you know, time translation, this is sigma times F. And F sigma squared is, yeah, that definitely looks familiar. Null infinity.
So this has to do kind of with what's in the back of your mind. I mean, why are you doing this? This question. So you're talking about phase space. So usually, you would think that that's some set of variables that will give you a global space-time solution, or part of a space-time solution. Of course, as you said, you don't. The dependent dependence is empty because you didn't include. But suppose you take it to a point, for example.
Sure.
Then you'll have a domain of dependence, at least into the past. Right? Your data.
Yeah.
Is that the kind of application?
Yeah, we weren't thinking. We weren't so thinking so much about solving equations of motion into the bulk. Like for me, it was interesting to figure this out, like just for its own sake, having that geometrical understanding of GR and what the degrees of freedom are on a null surface. The motivation was also to see if that interpretation of having the constraints as conservation equations for canonical currents, if that could be translated from null infinity to finite distance. And the answer is yes.
The Bondi analysis, which is usually known in the next command.
Sometimes
part of that is.
But then it goes sort of back to it goes back to infinity, this way of our not fixing the gauge variables, finding all the gauge momenta. So I think it is fruitful to do the same thing at null infinity.
And what about the horizon?
Yeah.
We haven't applied it to that, but that would definitely be a.
It's part of the motivation.
Yes.
So I guess it's a related question, but maybe pretty far away from what you were thinking of. Various reasons. I think it's interesting to say what implications does this have for the gravitational path integral. For example, what kind of, suppose you were trying to do a path integral to a, where you had a future boundary, which was, say, like that was a point, either including your flat top or shrinking it down to a point.
Okay.
Do you have a sense of what are the right variables on which this wave function all would depend? In other words, what do you want to hold fixed when you're doing the bulk path integral? In the space-like case, we tend to think we would hold fixed the event-induced metric. Here, that may be too much, right? It may or may not. I've never understood that. So I'm just wondering if it's the argument that it might be too much is that it's more like a complete set of symplectic. Hamiltonian variables.
Yeah.
It's not half like in a polarization.
Yeah, the phase space doesn't split in half as neatly.
Does this shed any light on this, or have you given some thoughts?
We haven't worked on that explicitly. I think where this may offer some perspective is in the spin zero sector. Of the area being conjugate to the spin zero momentum, which was a combination of surface gravity and expansion. I don't have a definitive answer on what to do in that sector, but this can be a start to figure out what the options are.
Yeah, you could also, when you think about dissipations, compute the transition pathway when you fix the amount of flux. How would you control exactly the boundary? Not just the non-boundarization, but how are we the boundary conditions that you can improve on this? So you can think, you know, beyond just conservative system, but open up to dissipative system.
Yes, that would be the margin.
I mean, this kinetic analysis is the closest you can get to proper boundary. It's the semi-classical level of boundary states. The next step is what I'm saying.
Then the last question I have, at some point you... This is the last question. You fiddled around with the... sort of integration by part to change it into a Dirichlet form. If you did the Dirichlet form, does that mean what you're holding fixed is the induced metric, precisely induced metric? And B, if that is what it means, in the end, is the action that you end up with the same one that we ended up with, or is have you compared,
The boundary actions.
Yeah,
it is the same one.
It is the same.
I mean, you also get it for other cases, like the coincidence of a null surface with a space-like surface,
right,
and so on. And these are not cases we've looked at, but like the ones we've both looked at, they
do it. Okay, so unless there are very urgent questions, let us thank Florian again.